My name is Connie Dunphy. Welcome to Southeast Alaska Sea Stories. This program is intended to reflect the beauty of the sea in Southeast Alaska. The program is composed of stories, poetry, and music, and it is about the people whose lives have been touched by the beauty and at times the ferocity of the sea. I'd like to dedicate it to the families and friends of Alaskan fishermen who have lost their lives at sea. Highway Captain Irv Hagerup knows the waters of Alaska well. He acts as a senior relief pilot for the ferry system. In this position, he fills in for vacationing pilots and has a working knowledge of all the vessels. Hagerup grew up in Juneau at Fritz Cove and started working on the ferries when he was just out of high school. He worked as a dishwasher. That was 20 years ago. Recently, I caught up with Hagerup on the bridge of the Aurora as he maneuvered the ship through Sturgis Narrows and Peril Straits. He admitted that this was his favorite route in Southeast Alaska.
Well, the currents run quite a bit there. We've just now coming out of Cackle Narrows into Salisbury Sound, where it's open to the sea. And the tides, we just went through Sturgis Narrows. The tides there can run up to 7 knots.
I asked Captain Hagerup if there are any memorable events that he can recall during his time at sea.
Well, oh boy, there's lots and lots of memorable events. Probably in the most excitement, I think Mr. Brown, my chief officer here, was on the Matanuska with me a couple years back when he called me just south of Juneau about Midway Island, and his only words were, "Man overboard, Cap." And I got up and we had to go back and pick a man out of the water who decided that he needed to jump off of our ship. So we went back and got him and brought him in safely. But those are some of the more exciting times that I don't like to repeat too often.
I also asked Captain Hagerup if he gets unruly passengers aboard at times.
Well, that's a common occurrence here. The little ones here, the little Conti and Aurora, have their moments, but Seattle Run seems to have their share of unruly passengers on a regular basis, and we have various times we've had to have the police called to meet us at a port to take off these unruly people, and most of the time though we're able to control them on board. We don't have a brig. I suppose if we had to, we could chain them to the car deck until we get to the next port.
How about wildlife? There are instances where orca whales have gone in for a kill. Have you ever seen such a thing?
Yes, as a matter of fact, one of the most vivid times when I've seen killer whales chasing whales was when I was a boy growing up in Auk Bay. There was a little humpback whale that some killers had chased, and they chased him right up on the beach over, actually, exactly where the ferry terminal is today. There. And at other times, as far as seeing killer whales attack whales, we see that off and on, not as often as, I've probably seen about 3 or 4 times over the years.
Have you ever seen the water turn red?
Oh yeah, they jump on top of the whale and they'll cover the blowhole, and while the others will attack and tear out its tongue. And it's just a lot of blood.
How about other wildlife events at sea that you recall?
We've occasionally come across bears or deer swimming across the channel. We've had to stop for them at different times. allow them to get across the waterway there.
I asked the captain if he'd seen any major shipwrecks.
The most vivid one that I can recall was in my youth there. When I was five, my father took me out to Lena Point to see the Princess Kathleen that had the Canadian cruise ship had run aground there and put her bow up high on the beach, and they had taken the passengers off, and my father and I hiked around the Lena Point and got as close as we could at the time, and I remember being very impressed at seeing the vessel with its bow so high up on the beach, and they'd taken her anchors out and hauled them up high on the shore trying to keep her from slipping off. But I remember being impressed by that vessel being up on the rocks.
Well, what shall we do with the drunken skipper? What shall we do with the drunken skipper? What shall we do with the drunken skipper lying in the morning? Well, we'll keel haul him till he's sober. Keel haul him till he's sober. Keel haul him till he's sober lying in the morning. Way hey, and up she rises. Way hey, and up she rises. Way hey, and up she rises. Now what shall we do with the drunken bosun? What shall we do with the drunken bosun? What shall we do with the drunken bosun? Her lie in the morning. Lock him in the forecastle with the skipper's daughter. Lock him in the forecastle with the skipper's daughter. Lock him in the forecastle with the skipper's daughter. Her lie in the morning. Yeah, but you ain't seen the skipper's daughter. You ain't seen the skipper's daughter.
A tanned, wrinkled visage studies the departing fleet. White knuckles grip a weathered gray dock railing, restraining an ancient body. Soprano gulls and diesel bass rise in crescendo. Staccato voices sing, "Farewell, old man." A weakened voice utters a response, a murmured phrase in discord. Sulfur vapors rise from slowly revealed beaches. They swirl and dance with smoke from an old briar pipe and capture the fragrance of salt air. Rising steadily, all three crash noiselessly against the clouds. Wake's final ripples lap against the shore as the last stern exits the harbor. Gulls return to cannery perches, dancing to the peals of the channel buoy. The briar thumps against the cupped palm, a timpani in the stillness. Stones reveal a fresh side as the figure turns in the gravel. An unsteady silhouette picks its way toward a familiar trail. A fresh rain shower begins, conveniently. No one will notice now a seemingly insignificant addition from an eye that has witnessed 70 seasons.
This summer I was honored to speak with an old-time fisherman from Sitka, Alaska. Pete Lytle is known to his friends as Oso Pete. Lytle, who is 91, fished the waters of southeast Alaska for many years. He now lives in the Pioneer's home in Sitka, which overlooks the harbor. His life started in 1895 in Norway, where his father taught him to fish. Oso Pete fished the seas his entire life, and in return, the sea has left him with many memories.
Someone said that when you were a young man, you came around the Horn.
I came through Straits of Magellan. That's pretty close to it.
What sort of ship? Was it a cargo ship?
Or? Was a big, pretty good-sized steamer, about 12,000 tons. You're riding on the rock in the Straits of Magellan, which they call Sanus Isle Rock. But I got patched up, and we went to the west coast. Still own a boat.
You do? And
the name of the boat is Stormy.
Is Stormy. Did you get this boat after?
Like a lot of wind. A fellow with the name of Bruce Ulrich is fishing it. I'm looking for him to come in anytime.
Do you get out and go fishing yourself these days?
People have been asking me to go with them, but I rather like to fish my own boat or go there.
Pete, what are some memorable fishing stories you can tell me?
Oh, I was whaling. I whaled in Australia.
What year was that?
That's quite a question. I don't recall. I don't keep track of that.
What kind of whales were you going after?
Oh, sperm.
What job did you have?
Well, I was deckhand. And then once in a while, I went out on a real big, pretty good-sized boat with a gun on the bow. So we shot them. Then we went and blow them up full of air so they flew and put the flag on them so we could go and get more. We got to throw them in, tail up ahead.
Did you ever have any close calls on the sea?
Yes.
Can you tell me about one?
Well, there you see that picture there.
Yes.
That looked like a pretty close one.
Yeah.
It was so cold. Ooh.
I'm looking at a newspaper clipping that is hung in Pete's room. It reads, plans are underway on Catlian Street to have Peter Lytle, otherwise known as Oso Pete, take a trip to White Sulphur Springs. The area remains his favorite, even though that is where his fishing vessel was bashed against the rocks and sunk in the winter of 1979. Lytle spent 6 weeks at White Sulphur Springs before being rescued. He said he took shelter in a little shack there. How did you eat? You were stranded for 6 weeks. What did you eat?
Mud.
Are you serious?
Yes. The only way I could get it was just, I had an axe there and a little shack that was a coal job. So in order to get water, I had to go down in there. I happened to have a chunk of pipe down in there. I had an old pot handle on and I had a drum open to keep the fire in that drum. And of course there was a pretty good drift pitch there. So, well, I just happened to have an axe to chop up that, so to keep this drum.
So you kept a fire burning constantly in your shack?
Yeah. My guns was on the boat, and I couldn't get out the boat. 6 weeks, I got picked up. The Christoviches, they are down around Ketchikan. They came and picked me up.
Pete said that at one time he tried to raise the Oso using 55-gallon drums, but the attempt was unsuccessful.
Well, she still, what's left of it is still there, they claim so.
He pointed out a photograph of the Oso that hangs in his room. This color photograph shows the Oso partially submerged. The picture was taken on a clear sunny day, and the blue sky and billowy clouds are reflected on the calm surface of the water. Because of this, it looks like the Oso is suspended in the heavens.
She's going to heaven with two drums.
Mother Ocean, I've heard you call, and I've wanted to sail up on your waters since I was 2 feet tall. You've seen it all. You've seen it all.
I spoke with sailors from the ships USS Thatch and USS Merrill at the American Legion Hall in Juneau, Alaska in October. I asked them what they liked about the sea.
What do you like about the sea?
Serenity. It's exhilarating. It's unrelentless. Mostly the feeling when I get out there and when the sun's going down, it's so peaceful, not a lot of noise from, like, back in the city.
You can get up in the mornings and go out, and as the sun rises, you can look into the sun and it's just peaceful, nobody out there to bother you. You come to places that you've never been before.
It's quiet. It looks peaceful and you look out and see the birds and see many a mile.
I like when you're way out at sea, it's nice. As in the morning I go up on deck and it's clean smelling. It's like, it smells like fall, like back home. It's got a changing nature.
before her, I watch as she creeps forward, stalking my bare toes, placing upon them a wet kiss. I tremble upon her and wipe from my face salted beadlets. Furious, she roars, reaching for me with frothy fingers, the final seductress. Her countenance and disposition brighten in the sunlight. Her gentleness reflects a myriad of lives. She yields to me, and I am nourished. I smile in my victory. Mockingly, she reveals the conquest of my essence. I vow soon to quit her, a trail in the mountains, and then I'll be free. I'll leave behind the danger, which is her guarantee. Then I hear her laughter, and from her moist lips the wind carries our secret. I have your love, foolish person, and you have only from me my promise to be inconstant. I am the inconstant sea.
As most of you probably realize, those are the sound of whales, specifically humpback whales. Whale researcher Scott Baker recorded those sounds using a hydrophone. Baker, who works for the National Park Service, was in Glacier Bay this past summer. In the fall, when the humpback whales start their long migration to their mating grounds, he travels to Hawaii to observe them there. I spoke with Baker after he had just completed another summer's work in Southeast Alaska. How long have you been studying whales in Southeast Alaska?
I've been coming up here now for 7 summers.
Could you tell me a little bit about your study up here?
Yeah, one of the primary purposes of our study has been attempting to understand migration, abundance, and social interactions of humpback whales. And one of our most powerful methods for that is individual identification. And this is simply being able to recognize individuals in a population based on their natural markings. And humpback whales are a little bit unique among whales and dolphins in having very characteristic, striking, or unique patterns of coloration on the underside of their tails. And since they lift their tails frequently when they dive, it's a good chance to take a picture of that. And it's very much like a fingerprint in how unique it is. We have now well over 1,200 whales in the North Pacific identified based on the characteristic coloration of their tail flukes. In fact, one of the local biologists here, Chuck Giraz, was one of the people that first began using this technique systematically in the late 60s and 70s. So some individual identification of whales here in Southeast goes back into the 60s from Chuck's work.
I imagine that it requires quite a bit of patience to photograph these flukes. Any estimates as to the time it takes to get a photograph of one of these?
Oh, no, photographing them is the fun part. The hard part is keeping track of all your records, getting the film developed, and then making all the comparisons that are required in order to re-sight the same individual. Each time we photograph a whale, we have to compare it to nearly the entire 1,200 photographs we already have to determine if we've seen it before and where we've seen it and who we've seen it with.
How many whales approximately are there in Southeast Alaska during the summertime feeding?
Over our seven-year study, we've identified over 400 individuals.
Are there more active individuals than others, and do you get so you don't have to use the flashcard method, per se, to identify whales?
Glacier Bay and the adjacent waters of Icy Strait seem to be a little bit unique in that we've had a small number, perhaps 24 whales that have returned there with a tremendous regularity for the past 15 years. Some of the individuals that Chuck Giraz first identified in as early as 73 still return, and I saw a few again this year. And yes, those individuals I don't need to even photograph, though I try to for documentation, but I know them like good friends in a sense. Whales in Frederick Sound, on the other hand, tend to congregate in much larger numbers. You can see as many as 100 whales down there in just a very, within a few miles of each other. And they tend to be much more fluid and more unpredictable and don't return with quite the regularity, at least to that specific area, as the whales in Glacier Bay.
Are the whales more restrained when they are feeding here in Southeast Alaska in the summer compared to when they mate in Hawaii in the winter? Do you see the differences?
The difference in their behavior in Hawaii and Southeastern Alaska is just tremendous. They're almost like different animals. The animals are extremely aggressive and competitive in Hawaii, apparently as a result of a competition between males for access to females for mating purposes. So when they come up here, pretty much thoughts of mating and so forth are left behind in Hawaii, and their consideration turns instead to feeding. You might expect that the animals would compete for food as well, and that you would observe aggression or something as a result of that. But for the most part, that's not true. They seem to get along quite well while they're feeding.
With this aggressive behavior during mating season, they fast. Is that correct?
That's correct. Their primary feeding is done here in southeastern Alaska, where the animals remain probably for 4 but up to 6 months. And during the migration south and while they're on the wintering grounds and on their return, very little feeding is thought to take place.
That's quite a long stretch of time. Are they reduced in their size when they return to
Southeast? Tremendously, yes. It's something we wish we could all do. They're probably able to shed nearly 40% of their weight across that period. And when they arrive here in May or early June, they are noticeably thinner. And you can see their little backbone sticking out, and you feel sort of sorry for them. By the end of the year, they're just their beam is tremendous, and they just look like they can barely dive. They're so fat.
Could you talk a little bit about their feeding habits? I've heard about the bubble nets.
Well, humpbacks are extremely plastic in their feeding behavior. A lot of variability, and some of that is a result of the fact that they take a very broad range of prey, from less than half-inch long euphausid, small shrimp-like animals, krill, all the way up to adult herring, probably 10 or 12 inches in length. Lunge feeding and bubble netting is most frequently seen, I believe, when they're feeding on euphausids near the surface. When they're feeding on the schooling fish, particularly the larger schooling fish like herring, we've observed them cooperatively feeding. It's a very sophisticated appearing strategy, much like has been described for wolves or orca, that they seem to circle the fish, school them up, using themselves as a net, their bodies as nets, to constrain the prey, and then lunging up through them as many as 10 at a time.
Have you yourself ever been involved in a bubble net?
Been involved in a bubble net?
Been entrapped in a
bubble
net?
Well, I have had my boat drift into a bubble net before, and that certainly is disconcerting when you begin to see the little bubbles. Had them lay bubble trails, which are not nets, but just long trails in Hawaii when I've attempted to snorkel around them. And finding yourself encased in a whole stream of bubbles in Hawaii with this 40-ton animal around you is very, very disconcerting, because you really are terrified for a moment. You can't see anything.
Scott Baker observed possibly a dozen whales in the vicinity of South Island in Stevens Passage when they were bubble netting. He recorded their clarion calls on a hydrophone. Incidentally, the National Marine Fisheries Service in Juneau sent a recording of these feeding calls down to scientists in California who were trying to lead the humpback whale Humphrey out of the Sacramento River last year. They played the recording, and Humphrey followed them back to the sea. Carnegie Medal of Honor at 8 years old for helping save a man's life at sea is no small feat. But for Southeast Alaskan Marie Laws, it was just another part of growing up near the temperamental waters of Cross Sound. Laws' parents ran a gold mine where Lisianski Strait intersects Lisianski Inlet, about 10 miles from Pelican. Boating was a way of life for her family. Marie Laws, who was Marie Mork then, now lives in Sitka. Laws says she recalls that she and her cousin, Betty Mork, were just young girls then. There was to be a picnic the next day at an area now called Sunnyside. The girls had run down to the water to ask their uncle, Tom Allen, for a ride. So began a passage that Marie Laws can recount clearly more than 40 years later.
We went down and asked him if we could get a ride with him to Sunnyside. Well, it was fairly late in the evening, and we started down, and he started talking to us about hearing a report that the Dixie, which was a boat from Pelican, happened to be the mayor of Pelican, Fred Wetka, a new man in town who was a mechanic, Helvig Christensen, and their son, who I always called Bubby. We were just no kids together. And they were out on a deer hunting trip, and Tom said he'd heard on the radio that the Coast Guard reported that a boat had gone aground, and it was the Dixie, and it was aground on Jacoby Rock. They weren't going to go out until the next day. It was really quite stormy, and the boat, I guess the Coast Guard boat, couldn't get there until like 9 o'clock the next morning or something, because it would have to come from Juneau. As we're on our way to Sunnyside, we were talking about it, and he said, you know, it should be slack tide right now, so if the weather's going to lay down, it'll be laying down right now. And so we ended up going out there, and it was like 10 o'clock at night by the time we were really going down the inlet. And it was snowing and it was blowing. It was really quite rough out. Boats do go behind Jacoby Rock, but you have to know the channel behind it. And in the dark and in the storm, we hit a rock on the way out. And we were getting ready to abandon the ship. Mm-hmm. And we threw stuff into the skiff, and a wave washed us off the rock. Well, we were taking some water by this time. Didn't you know, really damaged the boat totally, so that, you know, we were still able to operate it, but we could hear a man yelling. Tommy could hear this guy yelling, Tommy, and the thing was, it was a mechanic, and he could recognize the sound of the boat because it was it made such a different sound, the engine did. So, yeah, that's pretty incredible. What happened then, we continued on out there, and we anchored the boat, and like I said, we were taking water, but we were able to keep up with it with the pump. It was a hand pump, you know, it wasn't one of these wonderful pumps that you have anymore on board. And so we put Tommy over in the skiff, and we took a gas lamp and put it inside of a 5-gallon can and cut the side out of it. So then he left us after what seemed like a long time. We were taking turns pumping when we could hear Tommy coming back with the skiff. And he said, I'm sorry, girls, there's only one left. And we just said, who is it, you know, because of course, like, we were really close to this family that lived there. And it was Chris, it was the mechanic. He was, I guess he helped Tommy to get himself into the skiff, because there's a huge groundswell out there. And if you can imagine raising up and down on the groundswell, trying to pull somebody off a rock in a little punt, it was just an incredible thing. So we hauled him over the side, and I remember thinking, oh, his legs are frozen. We took him, put him in the boat, put him in the bunk. It was an old-fashioned little troller. His lips were black and quite swollen. So we had a hard time understanding him because, you know, him trying to talk through his swollen lips. His fingers, some of them had to be amputated. His legs had to be amputated at the knees. When we took Chris down the forecastle, we were worried because we had it warm with the cook stove down there going, and we were worried about him falling out. We turned the stove off, and we wrapped his legs in our jackets and stuff so the heat wouldn't get to it too fast.
Law says that the survivor, Helvig Christensen, told them that during a storm, the Dixie lost power and hit a rock which knocked the battery off its mounts.
And one of us would be talking to Chris, one of us would be pumping, and the other one would be steering. He must have been awfully strong. I would dream of them being found. I would dream of them being wild somewhere, oh, for years.
Right down on the shoreline.
The sea seems to spawn many a salty dog with many a tale to tell. Recently, I spoke with one of these salty dogs. Your name?
West Coast Johnny Langford.
How old are you now?
65.
What was the name of your boat?
The Helen J.
How long did you have the Helen J?
7 years.
Do you remember your call numbers?
W3944.
Did you fish out of Juneau?
I fished out to sea. This is child play.
The inside passage is child's play to you, Johnny?
Where's the mosquito passage to? I'm a deep sea skipper. Deep sea. I crossed the equator 12 times.
Are you still fishing?
Nope. A little deal, I am fishing.
Pardon?
Don't say pardon. Yes, I got my web ready. But they close the season.
What do you fish for?
The flat ones.
The flat ones?
Halibut.
Are those challenging to you?
I almost got thrown overboard by one of them.
Tell me about it.
It almost beat me. It did, actually.
You got it into the boat and it started flapping you?
That's right. When I hold it aboard, I never took such a whipping.
Did it send you into the hospital?
Nope. I landed it. You ought to have seen that. We call them whales. I shot it with a .22 pistol. That stalled it.
I see you got a broken nose. Did you get that in your fishing days? How'd you get that?
I'm an ex-bug.
What's a bug?
A fighter.
Where'd you fight?
Georgetown. Georgetown is old Seattle.
I see. What were you, a flyweight?
Walter. I weighed 148 pounds. British Steel. Had the golden belt. I was only 19 years old and I had a chip on my shoulder. But I'll say this. I was supposed to get married. My manager and Geraldine run off. I've never seen either one since.
According to West Coast Johnny, Geraldine, his girlfriend, and Johnny's manager took off with a $10,000 purse. West Coast Johnny pointed out to me that in 1938, $10,000 was nothing to sneeze at. Because of this, he said he went to sea. Years later, he found his way to Alaska.
Then I came to Alaska.
What year was that?
1950. February the 12th. I have a master's degree.
In what?
Mechanics.
Well, there you have it, matey, from West Coast Johnny of Juneau. The story has everything, possibly even the virtue of truth.
The times was hard and the wages low.
Leave her, Johnny, leave her.
And now once more ashore we'll go.
It's time for us to leave her. Leave her, Johnny, leave her.
Just as the sea is loved and revered in Southeast Alaska, it is also equally loved around the world. World literature is full of stories about the sea. There are the writings of a young American man just out of college who at 19 rejected the idea of entering his family's business and went to sea. Richard Henry Dana, in 2 years before the mast, gave us a sensitive account of losing a fellow sailor at sea.
Death is at all times solemn, but never so much so as at sea. A man dies on shore and his body remains with his friends, and the mourners go about the streets. But when a man falls overboard at sea and is lost, there is a suddenness in the event, and a difficulty in realizing it, which give to it an air of awful mystery. A man dies on shore, and you follow his body to the grave, and a stone marks the spot. You are often prepared for the event. There's always something which helps you to realize it when it happens and to recall it when it is past. A man is shot down by your side in battle, and the mangled body remains an object and a real evidence. But at sea, the man is near you, at your side. You hear his voice, and in an instant he is gone, and nothing but a vacancy shows his loss. Then, too, at sea, you miss a man so much. A dozen men are shut up together in a little bark upon the wide, wide sea, and for months and months see no forms and hear no voices but their own. And then one is suddenly taken from them, and they miss him at every turn. It is like losing a limb. There are no new faces or scenes to fill up the gap. There is always an empty berth in the forecastle, and one man wanting when the small night watch is mustered. There is one less to take the wheel, and one less to lay out with you upon the yard. You miss his form and the sound of his voice, for habit has made them almost necessary to you, and each of your senses feels the loss.
If there is anything that we all rely upon if we happen to get into trouble in the waters of Southeast Alaska, it is the help of the U.S. Coast Guard. The commanding officer of the Coast Guard cutter Cape Carter, which is stationed in Auk Bay, Alaska, says that he and his crew often run into the same problem when people are reported overdue. Captain Glenn Ryerson stresses that it is a problem which the public could help solve.
What we like to encourage people to do is when they're going to go out boating, they should leave a schedule or some kind of an itinerary with someone back here on shore that says when they're leaving, where they intend to go, and when they intend to be back. This way, if they do come in late, then we have some idea of where they, at least initially, were going to go, and we have some idea where we can start looking for them. And it would help the Coast Guard out a lot in conducting searches for overdue boats.
Being stationed on the Coast Guard cutter Cape Carter entails always being ready to act when an emergency is sounded. But along with the work, there comes a time when the crew is able to observe the beauty of Southeast Alaska. I spoke with navigator's assistant, Seaman Mahoney. He's been on board the Cape Carter for a year and a half. I asked him if he had any impressions which stand out in his mind.
Sure, I've seen a lot of things that, you know, at first I'm from California, and, you know, just being up in Alaska, just the a lot of the beautiful places I've seen is up here is one of the things that I really enjoy. I feel it's really an advantage to be able to patrol out like we do.
Name some of the places you've been, some of the more obscure places.
Well, one of the most beautiful places I've been to is a place called Punch Bowl Cove, which is, what's the name of that island, Captain?
Revilla Gigato?
Yeah, it's off Beam Canal.
Yeah, it's off Beam Canal, and that is, you know, just being there like kind of puts you in awe because there's not very many people have been there. It's just, you know, huge, steep cliffs. What makes it so beautiful, too, is it's so isolated, and it's so beautiful. You feel like you're really lucky to get to see something like that.
The Cape Carter's crew numbers 14. Everyone at one time or another has been new to the ship. The crew admits that when a new member comes on board, he often finds there's a lot to learn about life at sea in Southeast Alaska. I asked Seaman Mahoney if he had any recollections of these times at sea.
Yeah, I have a... Well, when you're new, when you're out of boot camp, you don't really know what's going on. And I had some bad things happen to me, and a couple other guys have too. One time, we had one guy, we put him on a buoy. You know, we told him it was a mail buoy where an airplane was going to come pick up this box, and it was going to take a package back to district, and that he had to put it on there. We've had some pretty funny things happen with the new guys. Me, myself, I was put on on the bow of the boat on a glacier watch one time. We were pulled in there, and they told me that if a glacier calved, that a tsunami could come and tip the boat, and that I was to stand out there on the front of the boat and watch for it. And so I was out there with a boat hook in my hand waiting for this glacier to calve. It was pretty funny.
Well, Jack was a sailor, and he walked up to town, and she was a damsel, she skipped up and down. And she says to Jack, as she passed him by, would you care for a purchase, some old bungo rye, ruddy rye? Fa-la-diddle-die, ruddy rye, ruddy rye. Says Jack to himself, Well, what can this be but the finest of whiskies from far Germany? Snuggled up in a basket and sold on the sly, and the name that it goes by is Old Bungo Rye, Ruddy Rye. Fa-la-diddle-die, Ruddy Rye, Ruddy Rye. Well, Jack gave her a pound, for he saw nothing strange. Hold the basket, young man, while I run for your change. Jack peeked in the basket, and a child he did spy. I'll be damned, did he cry, this is queer Bungo Rye, Ruddy Rye. Fa-la-diddle-die, Ruddy Rye, Ruddy Rye. Well, to get the child christened was Jack's next intent. To get the child christened, to the parson he went. Says the parson to Jack, what will he go by? I'll be damned, did he cry, call him queer Bungo Rye, Ruddy Rye. Fa-la-diddle-die, Ruddy Rye, Ruddy Rye. Says the parson to Jack, that's a very queer name. I'll be damned, did he cry, and it's a queer way he came. Snuggled up in a blanket and sold on the sly, and the name that he'll go by is Queer Bungo Rye, Ruddy Rye. Fa-la-diddle-die, Ruddy Rye, Ruddy Rye.
Thank goodness that all good sea captains keep logs. Many early impressions of Southeast Alaska have been preserved in these logs. Just as Teachakos have much to learn on their arrival to Southeast Alaska, some early explorers admitted that they did too, at least when it came to fishing. Having just sailed across the Pacific from China in 1787, English navigator George Dixon of the ship Queen Charlotte wrote an account of his crew's attempt at fishing and compared it to the techniques of the natives of Port Mulgrave, which is now known as Yakutat.
Our whaleboat was one day sent with seven hands on a fishing party, but their success was greatly inferior to that of two Indians who were fishing at the same time, which is rather extraordinary if we consider the apparent inferiority of their tackle to ours. Their hook is a large, simple piece of wood, the shank at least half an inch in diameter. That part which turns up and which forms an acute angle is considerably smaller and brought gradually to a point. A flat piece of wood about 6 inches long and near 2 inches wide is neatly lashed to the shank, on the back of which is rudely carved the representation of a human face. They bait their hook with a kind of fish called by the sailors squids, and having sunk it to the bottom, they fix a bladder to the end of the line as a buoy. Their lines are very strong, being made of the sinews or intestines of animals. One man is sufficient to look after 5 or 6 of these buoys. When he perceives a fish bite, he is in no great hurry to haul up his line, but gives him time to be well hooked. And when he has hauled the fish up to the surface of the water, he knocks him on the head with a short club, and afterwards stows his prize away at his leisure. This is done to prevent the halibut, which sometimes are very large, from damaging or perhaps upsetting his canoe in their dying struggles. Thus were we fairly beat at our own weapons, and the natives constantly bringing us plenty of fish, our boat was never sent on this business afterwards.
French explorer La Perouse wrote in 1786 that he found La Touya Bay a place of unusual beauty and that the waters were so protected that a voice may be heard a half a league away. He hoped to make it France's base in Alaska. La Touya Bay is the only haven for seafarers facing the open sea on the passage from Cross Sound to Yakutat. The entrance to the bay is narrow. When the tide is changing, it runs like a swift river through this entrance. La Perouse's affection for La Touya Bay came to an end when 21 of his finest officers and men tried to sound the waters of the narrow entrance. All the men were lost and none of the bodies were recovered. La Perouse built a monument to his men on La Touya Bay's central island and named the island Cenotaph, meaning empty tomb. But this was just one of the treacheries that La Touya Bay holds. Lying on the Fairweather Fault, earthquakes have buckled and jarred this part of the world many times. Scientists have been able to trace earthquake activity by where waves have previously swept over the land, denuding it of all trees and topsoil. These waves most recently occurred in 1853, 1874, 1936, and 1958. A man who is currently the captain of a Forest Service boat called the Sitka Ranger took the ride of his life along with a 7-year-old son in 1958. Howard Ulrich was awakened when the earthquake jarred his 40-foot fishing boat, the Edrie. He got up to see the formation of a wave he says he will never forget.
Something caught my eye. Towards the head of the bay, there were, you could see the mountains, the slides and things occurring on the mountains, and, you know, a lot of dust. And as I looked up there, the impression I got was very like a Hollywood motion picture, where the rains came and the dam breaks, and they show the big floods, you know, washing everything away, and that's, they do a good job because that's exactly what it looks like.
Ulrich says that he saw a landslide come off a mountain and drop suddenly into the water. Later, it was estimated that some 40 million cubic yards of rock and ice weighing 90 million tons fell into the water. This landslide produced a wave that went surging across the front of La Perouse Glacier and ripped up an opposite slope. He says that he watched an incredible amount of debris, topsoil, rocks, trees, that all came crashing back down into the water. This was not a tsunami. The earthquake had triggered a landslide which produced a wave. This wave, which was 1,740 feet high, is the largest wave ever recorded.
At that time, I thought we had to do something to try and save ourselves. So I started the engine on the boat and began to try and pull the anchor, because we were only anchored in 5 fathoms of water. Things just weren't working too well. I could see I wasn't getting the anchor up fast enough. The last time I looked up was when the wave hit Cenotaph Island, and I saw the wave hit the island and come completely, not clear over the whole thing, but there's a saddle in the middle of the island. And I saw the water come through that. Also, I saw the, at that time, the water came around the west side of the island, and the wave had washed all the overburdened trees off this flat ground, and had it out in front of it as it came around the other side of the island. And that was, it seemed like at least 100 feet high, straight up and down, and just black as coal with all these trees. Just looked horrible. On the east side of the island where I was located, the wave just continued as a large swell, large round swell. At that time, I assumed that I wasn't going to be able to pull the anchor, so I tied the chain off and tried to pull the anchor off by running ahead on it. This only succeeded in swinging the boat around sideways to the wave, or broadside to the wave. And at that time, I decided to back the boat around and get the bow into the wave in order to keep better control of it. And about that time, I was about 3/4 of the way around to be squarely into the wave by the time the wave arrived. The wave was still round, and it didn't break where we were, and I judged the wave at about 100 feet high. As we started up the wave, the front of the wave, the chain from the anchor, even though I'd tied it off, started paying out, causing sparks to fly. I also had the engine running wide open, full ahead. And we kept climbing, and I just was just dreading when the anchor chain came to the end. To pull down all 40 fathoms of anchor chain, when it came to the end, it didn't even slow us down. It just snapped the chain like a piece of string over the bow roller and just about the top of the wave. And having more control of the boat, I was able to keep the bow into it. As the anchor chain broke, the pilot house doors on, goes on out onto deck, out onto the deck of the boat, and I looked out through the pilot house door, and I was looking down into the trees, and I think that we were over the shoreline at that time. We got to the top of the wave, and I was surprised. We got over the wave and were started down the other side. And at that time, all the water that had been rushed up onto the shore came rushing off, and it was breaking. It was probably 20 or 30 feet high and just all foam. And so at that time, I had to turn back into that part of the wave.
After riding these waves out, he headed to the center of the bay. He describes the waves out there.
And they looked like one of these Japanese drawings of the ocean. That, if you've ever seen one, you'll know what I mean, where the waves kind of jump up and have little fingers and arms off them. And in about 15 minutes, it was all calm. At about this time, it got really foggy, dusty, foggy, and really smelled like earth. I didn't have radar or anything like that. We just had to feel our way out, run by compass to get out of the bay. It got so thick you couldn't see the shoreline.
Ulrich says that his 7-year-old son, Bruce, was quiet during this terrifying time.
About all I can remember him saying before we got out of the bay, that I think we're going to make it. And he said something, well, let's go home, Daddy.
Ulrich shared the bay with two other boats. The Swansons on the Badger survived the wave, but Mickey and Orville Wagner on the Sunmore lost their lives to it. Ulrich remembers that the evening before the earthquake, mountain climbers had just hiked out of those mountains and were picked up by a float plane. Later, Ulrich was to name a newborn daughter Edrie after the boat that saw him through Lituya Bay in 1958. Somebody thought to record the calls that came over the marine radio after the earthquake. The following is Ulrich talking to a friend back in Pelican.
Hey, Edrie to the Pauline, yeah. How you doing there, Shelley? Ah, the Eddie back. I was in Lituya Bay. I made out fine, I guess. All I lost was my anchor, so... And Stutz is all right. He's outside, so he can tell we're all right. We're going to be running home. Going to be running home as soon as we get the hell out of here. I don't know whether I want to get around that entrance yet, but she's filling in now. It's just a big black mass of roots and trees around here right now, and it's foggy. You can't see anything.
I'll call you back. You okay, Howard? Thanks for that. Your wife is here. She's kind of worried about you. Everything is okay here in town, so we'll see you then probably tomorrow sometime.
Other calls went like this.
We're about 50 miles north of Cape Spencer, and a glacier come down and straight into the ocean. We've noticed no tidal wave in the ocean. That is all.
Are you off the La Perouse Glacier? Is that the one you're referring to, La Perouse Glacier? Over.
I'm sure I don't know what the name of the glacier is. About 50 miles north of Cape Spencer.
Oh, roger. That's it. I'll probably pick you up down there. Did you hear that, Gil?
Yeah, Bob, I was just wondering here, how are we going to be in the shallows around the harbor for that? Is there any amount of swell going to show up in here, or
it's so dark in here?
As far as we know, that glacier fell in or something up in Lituya. It's the only place, and it's really come floating down today there. Oh, howdy, lucky, and heck, as far as I know, he's the only one that was in there. It broke his anchor chain and everything else. He had to jump out of a sack when he felt the tremors, you know, and by God, he looked up and there was nothing but a huge comber coming at him there. You don't know how he got out of it. And the whole side of his travel, the mountain fell in, was travel.
In 1899, John Muir, while in Glacier Bay, wrote about fellow explorer and photographer Edward Sheriff Curtis. Curtis, involved in his lifelong work of photographing Indians, had trekked to Alaska to take advantage of the available light that the long summer days of Alaska provide. Curtis and his assistant were taking pictures from a small canvas canoe under the face of Muir Glacier. As Muir and others watched from a hill, a big chunk of glacier broke off and plunged into the water. The boat, already riding precariously low from the weight of the two men and their equipment, vanished. It reappeared on a crest of a wave, only to be lost to view once more as a second chunk of ice roared into Glacier Bay. The watchers on the hill turned away, thinking that they had seen a tragedy. But Curtis and his assistant were lucky that day and rode out the wave.
Got on the boat already. Right angle, and that one pole. Here we go. There's that boom.
old bomb.
At this point, charter boat operator Howard Robinson has a lot on his mind. Each summer, he runs a charter boat to Tracy Arm, and he is also an avid photographer. Prior to starting his charter business in Southeast, he owned and operated a photography studio in Alaska. This past summer, he deftly maneuvered his charter boat, the Glacier Seal, around icebergs while he photographed them, and he also gave instructions to passengers as to how to get the best photos.
Hold it right. Right on 14, huh? There we go. Thank you very much. That background makes it all the better, I think. It's the most beautiful iceberg I've seen in 15, 18 years of traveling in this world.
Robinson admits that he really enjoys showing these sights to people from around the world.
We're now at the entrance to Tracy Arm and Endicott Arm. It's about 50 miles south of Juneau, Alaska. You know, after being all around Alaska, running tours here and there, Glacier Bay for 19 years, I find this the most beautiful place of all. The blueness that's in the icebergs is more pronounced, more of the deep indigo blue in this area, probably than any place in the world. The steep walled fjords, so spectacular.
What do you think of this?
Spectacular. Just spectacular.
It's great.
Very good.
Where are you from?
From Austria.
And you?
San Francisco.
Well, we'll head on up to Arm here some more. We'll see some more interesting attractions such as waterfalls and wildlife, and seals on the icebergs, and the mountain goats. And keep your camera ready. We are very fortunate today to have all this nice sunshine, backlighting, wonderful for pictures. And look at the reflection in the water. Isn't that beautiful? Well, if you look up ahead there, you'll see a number of seals on the icebergs. They come up in here for protection from the predators, killer whales and man. They usually have their pups up there and then stay most of summer. If you all go real carefully and go slowly out on the front and hold your camera real still, I'll coast you right up close to the seals. And then you'll have some real good close-ups of the wildlife. It's a beautiful sight when we do gradually get close. Oh, we've spotted two mountain goats over here off the left. Real rugged animal lives up here in this rocky. Two mountain goats over here on the port side off the port bow.
Howard Robinson showing visitors around a stretch of his neighborhood near Juneau in Southeast Alaska. This has been Southeast Alaska Sea Stories. The people you heard were recorded where they live and work in Southeast Alaska. We'd like to thank all those who contributed to this program. A special thanks to Juneau shantyman Bo Kelly and Petersburg schoolteacher and poet Eli Ribick, who contributed the poems Inconstant and 70 Seasons. Also, a special thanks to readers Chuck Souter and Rick Kemp.
This program was gathered, written, and produced by volunteer Connie Dunphy in the studios of KTOO-FM in Juneau, Alaska.